Ninja Mountain.
All right, here we are at, well, I guess this is, well, we're here on Saturday, it looks kind of, it's been, yes, the last couple of days have been pretty crazy busy. Thursday we got in and it was just artists setting up, so I didn't feel like I could just go up and start hammering people with questions. And then, of course, yesterday I didn't even make it into the art hall because there are so many cool little demos and presentations being made. But now I am here today, this afternoon here at IlluxCon 2, and my first guest here is Bill O'Connor, otherwise known as William O'Connor.
Hello.
Well, sir, you've been working in the industry for some time, and I thought we'd ask you a few questions about perhaps your working relationship within the industry, you know, with various publishers you've worked with. Maybe we could discuss your concept art that you produced for 4th edition,
okay,
which so many of our artists and listeners are familiar with by now.
Okay, great. I started working with TSR and Dungeons & Dragons in 1994 was my first commission with TSR. And so I started working professionally on the Dungeons & Dragons project with 2nd edition. And I've been through about a dozen different art directors. So the relationships are constantly changing as new art directors come and go and change. But I became a professional illustrator, started working on 3rd edition fairly heavily in the early aughts, about 2001, 2003. Started working very heavily with Dungeons & Dragons on 3rd edition. And then in 2006, was approached by Stacy Longstreet, senior art director at the time, to do concept art for their upcoming 4th edition.
Mm-hmm. Right. Now, what were your duties involving with the concept art?
When I was first approached in 2006, they wanted me to address some of the races and classes. So, as a player myself, since I was a kid, I was very familiar with the game, very familiar with the mechanics, and very familiar with the classes system and the races system. They're sort of, I think the Dungeons & Dragons system is the grandfather of all the everything that's come after World of Warcraft and all the other fantasy worlds that we know are roughly based on Dungeons & Dragons. So I was very familiar with them. So I was directed not to change anything drastically, to stay within the look of Dungeons & Dragons that had been around. It's a 30, 40-year-old property. So they wanted to keep that look, but sort of freshen it and give it a new look, a new approach.
Now, how many... did the concept art comprise most of your working time for some time there, or are you still doing a lot of book interiors and card art?
I was still doing a lot of card art and a lot of card art, interior art, book covers. Yeah, work for myself, work... but I was able to block out almost a daily block of time. I created a schedule, and it ended up being a conceptual process that took about 9 months of actual conceptual commitment of time. So every day, yes, I would work on it, and every week I would deliver artwork, and once or twice a week I would certainly have conference calls and look at other art with the art directors, and we would go over my ideas. And it's... the concept process is, I think, very different than the traditional illustration process in that it's there's not the artist sort of being separate and different and away from the process. He's very much involved in a creative process with a team. And I get a lot of, you know, students or young artists asking, what's the difference between illustration and concepting? And concepting is you are a team player. You have to be able to work in a team. You know, 5 different people working on the same thing, or a dozen people working on the same thing and tossing whole cloth ideas out or bringing in whole new ideas. And you need to be able to roll with that and grow with that.
Now, how did Wizards facilitate that conversation, that, you know, sort of visual conversation between you and the other artists on the team? How did they, you know, to get a sort of a unification of vision and at the same time bandy about the concepts that you were working on for some, you know, for the higher purpose of designing the overall look of the game?
Right. Well, like I said before, the look of the game was not... It was very important to them that it not change visually too much. They wanted it to remain definitively Dungeons & Dragons. But smaller changes. So it was almost on a, it felt like a, since we were all working remotely, we were in Seattle for a little while working on the project, but then we all went our separate ways and were working remotely. So files would be shared and discussions would be had via phone conversation and emails and whatnot. So it was mostly done remotely, and so it was just a lot of file sharing. You know, it would just in the early stages, it was very broad strokes of, you know, what does everybody think of this, and you would come up with an idea or a very. You would start as randomly as you possibly could, just be as experimental as possible, and then rein it in slowly. So it started with broad chunks and got refined and refined and refined and focused over a period of months.
Now, in recent years, you made a sort of a switch in your professional work, your day-to-day professional work, from the from oils and acrylics into the digital realm. And how have you brought forth some of the techniques that how well honed in the traditional media into the digital realm? How did you? How was that transition marked for you?
That's a good question. I've found that the digital medium has allowed me to experiment more as an artist. I think one of the greatest asset of the digital medium is that it's. I know you and I, Jeremy, have had conversations about, you know, be sure to choose the right medium for the project you want to choose. Choose oil when you want an oil effect. Choose acrylic when you want an acrylic effect. And it's important to choose digital when you want it to, when you want a digital effect. Don't try to fight the medium. And one of the great things about digital, at least for me, is your ability to make changes rapidly, to experiment, to work quickly, to work in layers, to go back from what you've done earlier and change it almost immediately, to do multiple versions of the same thing and see them at the same time in real time, you know. And that really has freed me up as an artist. When I was a student, I was extremely experimental before I became an illustrator. I was working in mixed media and photography and printmaking and I was working in assemblage and sculpture, and I was doing a lot of different mediums and experimenting a lot. When I got into illustration, sort of the acrylic oil standard reined in that ability, I feel, to experiment as an artist, because you were so restricted by the medium. You know, oil and acrylic require so much dedication to the craft that it can almost be limiting. You know, but when I started to experiment in the computer, I really was surprised at how freeing it was, because you could really make changes and experiment as fast as you can think of those changes and experimentations in color and texture and form and shape and format and in effect, and really you were unhindered by the medium.
No, what can you tell us about Mongolian barbecue? And you know, how can our listeners learn more about Mongolian grill?
If you wish to eat Mongolian barbecue, it's a great recipe. Just simply go into the garbage, find three of anything that you can possibly rummage together, add soy sauce and heat, and you're done. Maybe put it on noodles. That might be good.
Oh, okay. Well, you know, I have here a bent paper clip.
That paper clip? I have half a cup of coffee.
You have half a cup of coffee. Okay. I have a pencil lead. A pencil lead.
No. Soy sauce and noodles.
Soy sauce and noodles. Mongolian grill!
Mongolian barbecue.
I must apologize to the listeners home. That is an inside joke, and one I'm sure will be shared in the years ahead.
Mongolian barbecue is the best barbecue.
I met Bill back in, I guess it was 03, 04 at this point. It was Origin. It was Gen Con.
It was in Columbus.
It was an Origins show in Columbus.
Yeah.
And we found a Mongolian grill. And
barbecue.
We had a great time, and we walked the buffet line assembling various meats and veggies, sauces, and
it's a very unique culinary art.
That's right, and
assemble anything and put soy sauce on it.
We managed to kill each other over the next few days with the various recipes we had concocted on the spot, and the Mongolian grill has found its way into a few products that we have both worked on.
That's right. Yeah, I've definitely worked Mongolian barbecue guys into L5R cards.
Yep.
And no magic guards or anything, but yeah, it's definitely an inside joke that you can find in both our pieces. Yeah, if you look hard enough, you can find them.
fantastic.
If you look at the mule card in Talisman 4th Edition, you will find the ingredients for a very tasty Mongolian grill. So I challenge those who play the game to take a look at the card. And
it's a great game, playing by Mongolian barbecue.
So. Oh, thank you so much for joining us, Bill.
It's been a lot of fun.
Okay, well, I'm here this evening at the Artist Showcase. This event, many of the artists who cannot get into the main showcase are having an evening here to set up and display some of their work and their portfolio. And I'm here right now with Joe Wilson, who has been in our industry for about a year and a half doing card art and card art associated with board games.
Yep.
Maybe Joe would like to tell us a little bit about himself.
Illustrator, you know... went to school years ago, kind of fell out of it for a while where I was, you know, got into that grind of day job and so on. Mm-hmm. And, you know, reached that point where I realized, like, this is not where I was supposed to be. You know, I got to get back into doing the artwork and the gaming. And so for the past year and a half, 2 years, I just decided to really kind of buckle down and focus on it. And it's been a great journey. You know, I'm starting to see some success. I'm getting a little bit more exposure. And, you know, I hope it keeps building, obviously.
Well, you find yourself here at ILLUXCON, too, and I'm curious to know what were some of the things you were hoping to walk away with in terms of the experience, and what have you so far gained?
You know, really I just wanted to get, you know, those portfolio reviews with the pros, you know, the guys who have those seasoned eyes, and really tell me what they see that I'm missing, and it's that great response when you hear it, and it clicks, and you know, like, ah, yes, of course, you know, why didn't I see that? It's so obvious now that it's been pointed out, and that's really, I think, what's going to help take my work to that next level.
Oh, that is great. Now, what are you doing here this evening? You're showing off your portfolio. Do you have prints for sale, things of that sort, or is it really just more of a meet and greet for you, as I know a number of the artists here are offering things for sale, as an example?
Just a meet and greet for me. Up until the last minute, I thought I wasn't going to be able to make this convention, so it was just 2 or 3 days ago I realized my schedule opened up, and I was like, I got to try to make it. So I showed up with, you know, nothing much more than some little postcards printed up and said, I've got to at least get in there and start talking to people.
I was pleased to know you and I both worked on some of the same games. What was basically your start? I don't know if I got that part.
I got started first with Jim Pinto. He gave me a chance with with a game that didn't see release yet. I don't know that I should mention it necessarily.
Okay.
But from there, he was working with AEG, and he passed my name on to some of those art directors, and I started working with Legend of the Five Rings, and they were great. And, you know, I've gotten a lot of consistent work with them. That, you know, gave me a little bit of exposure. It gave me experience that I really needed. And from there, I was able to show my portfolio to a few other game companies, like Fantasy Flight Games and Phoenix Interactive, who has the Warlord card game now, mm-hmm. and start working with them.
Oh, thank you very much, sir. I'll let you get back to you. Again, it's going to be a busy evening. There's a lot of foot traffic, but I hope we'll see you here next year, perhaps.
Absolutely, and I have to thank you guys for the podcast. You know, it's an inspiration, and every weekend I get to download it, and while I sit down at my art table and start my weekend's work, you know, I get it playing in the background, and I feel like I'm kind of part of that art community.
Oh, hey, thank you so much, sir.
Thank you.
Right, I'm here with Matthew Stewart, and maybe Matthew, give a little bit of introduction. Maybe you could tell us about your where people can find samples of your work, how long you've been working within the industry.
Okay, well, you can find my website at matthew-stewart.com. I've been doing a lot of work for Magic the Gathering. I've done some book covers and some other stuff for Wizards of the Coast and, you know, various things. I was with a gallery called Doorway Gallery for a while, but now I'm on my own, and you know, that's basically it. Just looking for more stuff to do and more stuff to paint.
Well, excellent. Now you work in oils, and I'm looking at this stuff, and it is just, it's lush. You know, it's very richly detailed, and I can see that you spend a lot of time, I believe, collecting some really decent reference. I mean, I even with things like, I'm looking at some fantastic Lord of the Rings work, and what was some of the impetus behind producing those works? Because I understand they were done for personal pieces.
Just because I'm like a Tolkien nerd, basically. I've been one since I was 13, and I love the imagery. I'm a big fan of, like, John Howe and Alan Lee, and you know, Ted Nasmyth. I used to buy the Tolkien calendars when I was like, you know, in high school and stuff. Probably since 1990, I've been getting them. So just that's what kind of got me into fantasy a lot. That and, you know, old school D&D stuff, you know, Keith Parkinson and, you know, Jeff Easley, who's right over there, which is amazing, and, you know, Larry Elmore, Clyde Caldwell, all those guys. It just got me into fantasy art.
No, I know that you did the, basically it was a repackaging for the Hunter's Blades
yes.
trilogy for, by Ari Salvatore for Wizard Books.
Yeah.
And I'm curious to know how that project came to be and how what was like the working process was like.
Well, I had already done one cover for Matt Adelsberger, who's the art director at Wizards for the novels. And I don't know, I guess he had seen a painting I had done with a lot of dead orcs and stuff, so maybe he had an idea for a... Well, he didn't want an action scene. It was like more of a kind of a... Like a... more of a... austere kind of poignant moment scene, you know what I mean? It's when Drizzt finds his Bruinor and thinks he's dead. So I guess Todd was just busy or something, or they wanted a little different look, so they gave me a shot. And I don't know, I guess I hope I did okay, you know.
That began with a I presume a series of rough sketches, and what was the back and forth like, if you can comment to it?
Well, they gave me, you know, they gave me like a brief description of the scene they wanted, and they gave me you know, some reference for what the characters would look like. I had already had like you know, online looked at like a lot of Todd Lockwood's designs for Drizzt's character, so that was already there, and you know, so I just came up with a bunch of small scenes. I have some sketches here that are actually from that, so you can't see them on the podcast, but, you know, mm-hmm. some small watercolor scenes. You know, there was the only real difference was that basically background, how destroyed the castle was going to be. He liked one sketch over another, and, you know, from there it just went to the finish. You know, I posed for Drizzt. I posed for all the dead guys. My wife took the pictures. I made, you know, I had some old, you know, ratty, you know, cloth and stuff that I made costumes out of and stuff. I kind of have to do that stuff. To me, the better reference you have, the better painting that you're going to have, the more information you can glean. You know, I mean, you take it as far as you can do without reference out of your head, but from there, use the reference to inform that. But the better reference you can take, the more creative you are, like the more things you might find, like lighting effects or just, you know, things that the body might do in a certain pose, things like that. You know.
And how did you come to learn about Ilux Khan, and how did you come involved with it?
Well, I had met Pat. I've actually learned about his website from someone I was doing a painting for, and you know, they had urged me to contact Pat, and because he was always you know, open to meeting new artists and helping new artists out, and giving advice, and just, you know, is a great resource for connecting artists with buyers of, you know, paintings, and just, you know, just all around great in the business. So I did, and, you know, he bought a painting from me called Swords of Evening Star, which was a book cover for Wizards, and from there, you know, I had talked to him from time to time, and, you know, when I heard about he was doing the Ilux Khan thing, it was just great, because, you know, he gave me some space there, and, you know.
Now, what are some of the considerations that you take into effect when you come to a show like this with your, you have the intention of selling artwork, and what are some of the things that you keep in mind when you hang your show and you assess prices and things of that sort, because pricing is usually the hardest thing to come up with.
Yeah. Well, the pricing is, I base the pricing on what I see around and what I've sold stuff for before, you know, and kind of where I think I am in the pecking order of artists, you know what I mean? I incorporate the price of the frame, you know, because you're selling all, like, oil paintings. I worked as a framer for 5 years before, you know, finally getting illustration jobs. So I know how to frame pictures, and I'm real sensitive to, you know, putting a good, nice frame on a picture, too. And I think it helps, you know, it's presentation, you know. I think that helps the impression of the viewer on the painting, looking at a painting, so... You know, it's that, and just thinking about what would sell for people. I, you know, bringing smaller things and prints and stuff, and like anything else, it's basically a gamble. You know, you never know exactly how it's going to go. You know, so,
Having participated here, did you take in any of the demos and presentations?
Yeah, I actually, well, on the first one, I was able to do a demo, and it was kind of daunting because it was me and, you know, Bob Eggleton, Tom Kidd, and Michael Whalen. So it's like three big shot and me, you know what I mean? So, but it was fun, you know. And once you loosened up and got over the fact that, you know, you're painting with these guys, it was fun. But this year I didn't do any demos, so the pressure was off. I got to see a lot of other demos, you know, talks, and, you know, they just had an art director talk, which was really, I learned a few things from, and, you know, it was a little disconcerting, but it was also, you know, informative, and, you know, just with, you know, just the way the market is and the competition, because it just keeps getting better, you know.
Fantastic. Now, are you doing any further shows this year, or is it all getting ready for next year?
Well, I do a lot of magic events, too, when the stuff comes out. I have one in December, actually, in a few weeks, and one in February, and I do some local shows like LunaCon, and I'm going to do my best to be at Gen Con this year. I meant to be at Gen Con this year, but we had some stuff that we had to do, so, yeah.
Well, is there any advice you'd like to offer to some of our listeners who are perhaps just starting out in the industry?
You know, just be persistent and just do the art that you like to do, because that's the art that you're going to do the best, and just work hard at it, and just keep your drawing strong, you know. Drawing is the most important part of it, so that's at least what's, you know, I try to do.
Certainly. Hey, well, thank you so much, Liz, for talking with us.
No problem. I appreciate it.
Okay, I'm here with Laura Deal, and Laura does a lot of work for some of the small press companies doing young adult readers, and she has a diverse, she does work for a diverse number of companies, but I thought we'd let her give a little bit account of herself.
Yeah, I work primarily digitally. I work with Photoshop and a large Wacom Intuos 2. And, yeah, my subject matter is mainly young adult fantasy. I like things that are glowy and colorful. And, I don't know, do you have questions for me?
Or? Yeah, let's see here. I won't ask you what brushes you use, but I will ask you what your favorite software is, and maybe how long a typical piece for you takes. I mean, I can see that you it's very detailed, so I kind of like to know a little bit.
Yeah, I've used quite a few digital programs. Right now, my favorite is Photoshop CS4. I've used it now for about 10 years, various iterations of Photoshop, and I feel most comfortable with it. Actually, it's kind of funny with me, the custom brushes. A lot of times I will make them for a painting, and then I'll lose them. And next painting, I'll have the same thing to do, and I'll make a slightly different variation of, you know, said leaf brush or said, grass brush. And so I find it fun making brushes, so I guess that works. But my typical piece, I take about 40 hours a piece, and that includes, you know, various stages of, you know, multiple sketches and stuff, and, you know, to arrive at the final painting all the way through.
Who are some of the artists that you like to look at and for inspiration and just education?
I'm really into the author illustrators, say Chris Van Allsburg or someone like Mary Grand Prix, her work. I love the Hildebrandt's work. I go for kind of the clean, colorful aesthetic. Not total photorealism, though I do quite appreciate, you know, the kind of the realism that a lot of artists will bring. Michael Whalen is definitely
I just had the opportunity. I just interviewed Michael actually earlier this afternoon, and it was very interesting. It was very interesting. Hey, what were some of the things you were hoping for from your involvement here at IllustCon this year, and what have you learned?
Well, I saw the convention as a peer-to-peer sort of gathering, and I was very excited about that because I know that it's a tight-knit, small group, lots of very amazing illustrators, and I really have just received wonderful feedback from numerous and very, you know, respected art directors, illustrators, and it's amazing who will take the time to go through piece by piece and give you wonderful feedback on your work.
What was your, you went to some of the presentations, and what was your favorite?
I really think the art director panel was one of my favorites, because five different viewpoints from, you know, across the board, really, really amazing people. Yeah, that's quite helpful.
Well, thank you so much for speaking with us, and you want to give a shout-out to any of the ninjas on Ninja Mountain?
Socar. I really enjoy what you do on the podcast. It's quite lovely to listen to that while I'm painting, which I have been doing lately. So, yes, thank you.
Right. Hey, where can people find samples of your work?
LDL.com.
All right. Well, I'll be sure to post a link on when this posts. And, well, thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
All right. I'm sitting here with Larry Elmore. I'm sure one of our listeners is well aware of Elmore's work. And I guess we could start maybe just a brief intro here. You worked in-house from about 1982 onwards.
I think 81 to 87 or 88, something like that maybe. It was about 7 or 8 years there, sort of during the heyday of TSR.
Yeah. I actually just had an interview with a few days ago. I spoke with Jeff Easley and Errol Otis about the early days of Dungeons & Dragons art.
So, Errol Otis?
Yes, yeah.
I haven't seen him in a while, man. He wasn't... Where'd you find him at?
Actually, Joe Goodman over at Goodman Games was producing a book that kind of featured old school D&D, and he happened to be working with Errol, and he came to me asking about doing a sort of a podcast discussion about the early days of D&D art. Yeah. And now you guys came in, prior to that, we had teams of Errol, Otis, Jeff D, among others, who had been working in-house.
Bill Willingham.
Bill Willingham came in with... with Tim Truman around the time that you got started as in the color art department.
Yeah.
What was it like for you in those early days working with Jeff and Keith Parkinson and Clyde Caldwell?
Well, I got there first. I was hired. And then I knew Jeff. We're both from Kentucky. And I knew him. I'd met him about a year before that. He was in New York trying to get some freelance work. And he's getting a little bit, but he had young kids, high expensive living, and he was really looking for more money, and he called me up and he said, I heard you're working for that Dungeons and Dragons place. And I go, yeah. He said, do you think they hire me? I go, oh, sure. Yeah. I said, they're looking for painters. And I said, send your portfolio out. I promise you they'll hire you. And so he sent me his portfolio, and he set up a time. I told Jim Rosloff at that time was the head of the art department. I told Jim about him. He said, yeah, I'll set up a time for an interview. And so Jeff came out, and they hired him. And then next came Clyde, and they hired Clyde. And then about a year later, we had this young kid's art submitted. And he was 22 years old. His name was Keith Parkinson. And we looked at him like, I don't know. He's got a lot of potential. I don't know. So Jim said, I think I'll take a chance on him. And Keith came in, and my God, it was 2 years later, he was painting like an old pro, and that's sort of, about, I guess, by maybe 83, 84, right in there, we were, the four of us was there as full-time painters. We all worked in one big room and had a blast. It was a ball of fun.
Wow. I understand around that time, it was, TSR was becoming aware of itself as a brand with the Dungeons & Dragons line. And in what ways were you called upon to help formulate and really to kind of iconify that brand? I mean, what are some of the constrictions they may have placed upon you, or perhaps they gave you guys a lot of carte blanche with which to explore?
There's a little bit of both. It's sort of weird. I mean, the neat, unique thing about it is almost everyone who worked there were consumers of the product. We played the games. And so by playing the games, the more we played, the more we saw how the art should be. For example, we did, most of us would do whole scenes. The weather, the landscape was important. Everything was important as far as gameplay. So you want to make the paintings as close to reality to convey that real reality to the player. And so we had freedom, and the company liked us doing that. The ones, seemed like the higher up you got, with the exception of the Bloom Brothers and Gary Gygax and so on, a lot of those people didn't play. But those guys and all your creative staff did play the game. And but then there would be times they'd put a restriction like, oh, well, they got scared about painting women because some mother had written in and said, they don't like these chainmail bikini things, or they didn't want any blood on. So there's a little time for about a year or so, if you painted blood, it had to be green. You couldn't paint red blood on a cover. Some silly things like that. And usually, we just go ahead and get around it, you know, or just do a couple and then forget about it. And eventually, the management would forget about it, you know. But usually, those decisions didn't come for the creative people or even Gary or the Blooms. It usually came from some middle management that read an article someplace, well, we shouldn't have red blood on a cover or something like that, you know, some stupid something. We just work around it, usually.
You know, Jeff told us a little brief story about the dart games that you guys used to engage in the middle, you know, towards the end of your work day.
They were life and death games, and they were dangerous. If you came through our door during lunch hour, if you came through fast, you could get a dart in the head. You had to watch it. You know, we nearly hit a few people, but we would always choose sides or randomly choose sides, and we had Jeff Butler was there. He was an inker. A black and white guy, and then there was Diesel, Dave LaForest. He was a mapper, so we had three on a team. And man, we had we was all competitive, so we had some wild dart games, but they were fun.
I understand that, I believe it was Carrie came walking by one day during the midst of one of these games, and you guys kind of, bosses here kind of,
yeah.
kind of moment.
Well, one, we would have these giant rubber band fights. I mean, somebody in shipping decided to give all of us these big boxes, huge boxes of rubber bands. They just come one day and put this one box by everyone's desk, and we open them, look, there's every size rubber band in there you could think of. And it didn't take like a day or two, pretty soon we're having rubber band fights, you know. Well, these rubber band fights got to be really, really wild. And there'd be some, especially in the evening, we get a little flaky, a little zippy, and you'd be sitting there painting, and maybe Butler would aim a rubber band at my palette, you know. And all of a sudden, the rubber band comes shooting through and hits your palette and slang paint, like, God bless. You'd look over and he'd be back working. You knew it came from his direction. You'd pull one out and you'd try to shoot, you know, his brushes or ink or hit him in the side of the head, anything, you know. And so you'd shoot one of him, and then Keith would join the fray, and then pretty soon everybody was shooting. And we'd be on the floor, low crawling between areas, trying to kill each other. And one day we was doing all this, having this horrendous rubber band fight, and Lorraine had taken over them. And on one side of our room, the big studio there, it was all glass because, and you could see into pre-press, what they call it. And it's just some women worked over there. We knew them all, and we didn't pay attention. We hardly ever looked at these windows. And somebody happened to look up at those windows and like, oh, my God, guys, get back to your desk. And we're like, what? So we looked up, and there was Lorraine standing there with a whole Japanese tour group watching us have this rubber band fight. We're like, so we tried to be cool and sort of slowly work our way back to our desk and start painting again without being too obvious. And then about 10 minutes later, here she comes walking in with this tour group, and we're like, oh, we're painting away, and we didn't say a word about anything. Oh, man. But we had some... Keith had a big fluorescent light, all of us did, above our board, but Keith kept all these miniatures on sitting on top, and we would shoot for those miniatures. You hit about 10 of them at once. They go flying down across his paintings. We'd shoot for a wet painting. If he was working, we'd try to get a rubber band hit right in the middle of one, so it'd make you finish. You had to go back and... you know, patch it up. We were bloodthirsty in those rubber band fights. But.
Well, who was the best shot?
I don't know. Keith was pretty good, man. He was pretty sneaky. Well, Jeff Easy was the sneakiest one. Jeff's quiet.
Yeah.
And
I noticed that about him.
When you really get to know him, though, he is funny and witty and crazy, but he's pretty quiet until you really get to know somebody. And Jeff's chair always squeaked. It would rock the chair. And you'd be sitting there, be quiet. And maybe all of a sudden you hear this squeak, 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 squeaks. And that's Jeff sitting there. He's sort of rocking back and forth looking at his painting. And then sometimes a few minutes after that, all of a sudden the rubber band come whizzing by you. And you knew it was Jeff because he's over there rocking and just not doing anything. And you look right at him and he's like looking at his painting real serious, but he's still rocking. But you knew you think it was him, surely, you know. And then I look at Keith and... Keith just sort of feel me, look at him. Keith looked at me like, go, what? I go, you shot a rubber band. He said, no, I didn't. So I'd go back to work, and then pretty soon a rubber band come from Keith's direction. So got him started. And lots of times, Jeff would start one, but you didn't know it until later, you know. And Clyde was always the last one to join. He'd be over there trying to avoid everything, just paint. And then we'd all decide to nail Clyde at once, and then he'd get into it. And, But we had a ball of fun. And I think some of the game designers out there, they had all the cubicles, and they'd get in these big fights, rubber band fights, and, and different kind of fights out there, dodging cubicles till one of the bosses would come out, everybody get back to work, you know. So, it's a bunch of creative people. What do you expect, you know?
At what point do you think they stopped delivering fresh boxes of rubber bands here?
Pretty soon we couldn't get rubber bands, man. We had to go scrape them up trying to find where we lost them. They didn't break us anymore.
Oh, man. Now, you and the team had worked quite closely together on, Dragonlance, as an example. And what was it like to sit as a team and discuss the concepts? So I understand there's a lot of back and forth between yourselves and the writers of the books as well.
Well, when Tracy Hickman came up with the original idea, and it was right before Margaret Weiss was hired, and he told Harold Johnson about it. Harold was his boss at that time. It was like from game design, and Tracy was a new game designer, just came on board. And he had this idea about Dragonlance, the basic story and stuff. And so Harold liked the idea. And at that time, nothing had been created from the creative department. I mean, everything was AD&D, and it's come out of the world of Greyhawk and a few modules and stuff. So this was a bold attempt to come up with a product from the creative people, not necessarily from Gary or somebody like that. And so Harold and Tracy came to my house, and I think this was the first discussion was even before Keith and Clyde was even hired. Jeff was hired, I think, but he was new. He just got there. So they came to my house and met in my basement. I had a studio in my basement. And they went over the whole Dragonlance saga and everything. And they said, you know, maybe in a few months we'll have it together enough to present this to the board. Well, it took about maybe a year before it got that far. And by that time, Margaret was hired, and Tracy and Margaret was really wanting on board for this. And Tracy was more of an ideal man and a story plotter. At that time, he didn't do much writing as far as book writing. It was more game design. Whereas Margaret came from book writing, you know, from a writer's point of view. So they became a natural team. So by the time we presented it to the board, and I did some refs that day to help show a little bit of the visuals of what it could be like, and the board bought into it and said, yeah, we're going to do it. And so I sort of ended up being like the art director of Dragonlance, and I didn't know there's going to be these reoccurring characters, and so my goal was to talk to the artists and convince them that we're going to be all working on this project. Some of it at the same time, and it's going to be cranking up, and these characters are important. So whenever you do one of these major characters, talk to Margaret and Tracy and get their opinion and get their input, because the books were starting to be written, so we were starting some of the art before the books were even written. And like I read the manuscript for the first, at least for Chronicles, the first book or two. They had the first book written, so I read those, but by the time I was illustrating the third book of the Chronicles, it hadn't been written yet, you know. And but anyway, so if I'm going to do racing, I think Jeff, no, let's see. I forgot who was the first one to do, like, racing. And I said, well, talk to Margaret Tracy, and then we'll try to match that. And if we'd have known, Dragonlance was going to be a three-year project, and that was it. If we'd have known what it was going to be, we'd have gotten models or something so we could be consistent. But it's going to be, you know, 2-3 years, a few products, and it's over with. And so we were just making the characters up. And then we'd go, like, if I painted someone first, and if someone else is going to paint that same character, they'd go over and look at it and get the basic idea of the costume and go back and try to at least put that costume on the guy and try to get close to the same features to get some consistency. And some artists, some of them work closer that way and put more effort into it than others. And Keith and I became more really hammering at home, you know, trying to tie up loose ends a lot. Some of the characters, like the Draconians, we was never really happy with, and I didn't have an idea. I said, I don't like what we're doing. I tried to do some designs. I didn't like it. And a new calendar was going to come out, Dragonlance, and I think I was assigning the art for it. And told Keith. Keith said, you know, we've never done Draconians. He said, let me do a painting of Draconians. I said, okay. He said, I got some good ideas. I said, good, good. And then he also said, we've never done Gold Moon and Riverwind the way Margaret and Tracy really wanted them to. I think Clive was the person who did Gold Moon. He did it pretty sexy. And Margaret didn't like it, so Gold Moon should not be sexy. And that really tore her up. And Clyde Evergrove, he painted with sexy, you know. And so the next time I painted Gold Moon, I put pants on her anyway. I toned her down. So, but Margaret's view of them was, and Tracy's, was they were more like American Indians. And so in that calendar, I don't know what year it was, but that's when Keith did the big painting. It was a center spread called What Do You Mean We're Lost with the Draconians in the Snow? I thought, they're Draconians. That sort of set the standard for Draconians. And he also did a painting of Gold Moon River Wind that a lot more American Indian. And so the next time I painted Gold Moon, a couple of times later, I sort of split from the old, I mean, I took some of what Keith had painted and some of what Clyde had done and some of where I'd put the pants on her and sort of put it all together. You could still recognize the characters, you know. So we did the best we could without models, just trying to, at least the costumes would carry through, you know, because we all painted and drew a little bit differently, you know. But it was a ball of fun. We enjoyed it.
And you continued to work at TSR for a number of years.
I think around 87 or 80, no, it was 88, I guess. I went freelance. Keith went freelance. Might have been 87, because Keith and I shared a studio for over a year. And we moved out and got our own studio. And the reason we quit is because I'd always kept a freelance schedule on the side, too, almost full time. So I'd work myself to death. And I knew that at that time there was a lot of, there was always a struggle with management in TSR, fights and battles. And sometimes they would decide to do things that was not necessarily the Blooms or some, but sometimes during these battles, the middle management would take over and decide they would do games their way, and they'd waste money, lost tons of money. Gary went out to create TSR West and went through a lot of money there, and the company just was getting in financial trouble, more financial. And when I quit, I told my wife, I said, this company will not last 5 years. And I said, I'll give it 5 years, and it's going to be sold or something. And I think it was less than 5 years it was. And Keith felt the same way. It's like, let's get out now while we're getting it, because he was working full-time at home doing book covers. Doing work. We couldn't do direct book covers. That'd be direct competition. So we were doing things that wasn't in competition with TSR. And but it got to the point we're going to have to, and so when Margaret and Tracy went out on their own, their next set of books was done through Bantam Books, and they wanted me to do the cover. So I knew if I did this, I was cutting my own throat. So I agreed to do the books, and the next week I told TSR, I'll give them a 2 weeks notice, and they want to know why, and I told them why I was going to do what. Took them off, but I had a big long talk with Lorraine, and I think I left under good. I mean, she understood what was going on. So I want to freelance. So I can make more money in the long run. And I mean, she offered me a lot more money, but that's art director. I don't want to be art director. I want to paint. I don't want to push paper. You know, at that time the illustrator made so much, art directors made more. You know, because they were the boss. Yeah. It's like, well, I don't want to be that. I want to paint. That's all. And like, why couldn't you pay me that to paint? You know, and eventually I think they did. Jeff stuck around. I think they paid him a lot more for painting. But it was, and then it wasn't long till, you know, they got in worse trouble. And luckily Wizards bought them, because we were afraid who's going to buy them, you know. But Wizards that time, they were gamers.
Yep.
And we're like, oh, good, I'm glad they bought it. You know. So it done okay. But then, of course, with Magic, they made so much money. Then Hasbro comes in there with bajillions and buys everybody out, you know. And so that's how things go, though, you know. But it was during those years, it was about 8 years there that I worked, that we all worked together. It was the most fun years I've had as working as an illustrator for a corporation, for a company. You know, it was a blast.
And you're still long friends with many.
Oh, we are.
I know you and Jeff exhibit together at Gen Con and a lot of shows together.
Well, last night, at the buffet, I walked over, I got my food turned on, and there was a whole table of ex-TSR employees. There was Jeff Easley, me, there was Alan Pollock, there was Brom, and there was Rob, mm-hmm. and seemed like, and then me, and so Brahm's wife, she goes, I got to get a picture of this. It's for some, this many, you know, all artists sitting there at the table. Mm. And all we were missing was Clyde, or, you know, and a couple like that. And but it was pretty neat, so all of us sitting there together. And we still sort of, we'll see each other a couple of times a year at different conventions, sometimes running into each other. It's still fun.
I know you continue to freelance, and lately you've also been doing a lot more in the private commissions. Yeah. And what has that been like for you?
Well, right before Keith died of leukemia about 3 or 4 years ago. But not too long before he died, we talked on the phone, and I went out to see him shortly before he died. And we talked about how when we had a studio together, we would talk about when we were 50 years old or so, we're just going to be doing our own thing and having fun, you know, with art, not always being art directed to death and all this stuff. Well, he died when he was about 46 or 47. And after I got the news that he died, I was home and I'm like, I don't want to, there's nothing I want to illustrate anymore. There are no books I want to illustrate. I don't know. I don't want to be pulling all-nighters at my age. I don't want to be letting deadlines control my life like it had been for the last 30 years. About 30 years, I guess. And I'm like, you know, I don't want to do that. So I thought, well, you know, you still got to make a living. You still got to pay the bills. So I was like, I'll do private contract work. Well, I got booked up for about 2 or 3 years worth right off the bat, and I'm still working on some of that stuff. And so I've been doing private contract, but even there, some of that's starting to get old, especially when someone's paying you a lot of money for a painting, and they're telling you what they want. It's like, but that's sort of like what I was doing anyway, doing what somebody wanted. So I'm at the point now, I'm really doing less. I'm still doing private contracts, but I'm trying to tell people, if you let me do it my way, you'll get a better painting, and it'll be cheaper even. Just let me do what I want to do. And some people are cooperative, some are not. So on those, I'll just have to say no to. And I'm still at the verge trying what I like to do full-time is just paint what I want to paint and make prints and sell the originals. And if somebody wants to publish it, fine, you know. But I really want to paint. I'm old enough. I've been in the business. I paid my dues. I would just like to paint my thing, you know. But you still have bills to pay, and I've got a studio to run. I got an assistant full time. I pay, and so you still got to make the money. You got to make so many thousand a month, no matter what. You know,
you've gone a route that many artists have gone, and that is you've developed your own brand of sorts around your name. I mean, I'm looking at the book, and your signature has its own little, really a logo in it to itself. And I mean, what are some of the things that you've experienced in that regard? Kind of developed your in that direction.
I do some self-publishing on sketchbooks and things, and when I get enough sketches to put a new book together, I'll put one out, and mainly you can buy them through my website or at conventions, and you're skipping the middleman and the triple man and whatever else is in there. You get a good enough profit margin to make it worth your while, and with the prints and the websites and everything, and I go to conventions. I love going to conventions. That's where you meet. Well, I've been to so many over the years. You develop a family out there all over the country, even the world. If you don't go, you won't see these people, and they're great people. So you keep going, and you don't know when you're going to quit because you have so much fun going and sort of partying with these people and great fans and just great friends. And you make money at it. And I give some classes, a couple of classes a year. We've been giving some classes in France, and not much classes, a lot of partying, a lot of touring, and just having a good time and trying to enjoy life more. But there's still work involved. There's nothing, there's no free ride on anything. But I'm just trying to enjoy it more. I still love painting as much as I always have. I just want to paint more of my own art, which would still be fantasy, but maybe.
I'll pause it. There we go.
Well, I think before we were interrupted, I was talking about just wanting to just enjoy the art and have more fun with it. And coming to this, I mean, this Alexicon, however they pronounce it, It's been, I've loved it. All the artists that are here, there's no place ever there's been this many well-known artists, world-known artists in one place in all my life. And it's just great. And we sit around at night and talk about art, and everybody's got the same problems, the same, you know, bitching about the same thing, you know. And most everyone wants to do their own thing, you know, and try to enjoy the art and enjoy your art. You know, you paid your dues. You worked all these years hustling and painting and being art directed to death. And after you've been doing it several years, I think when you're young and you know, in your 20s and 30s, you're taking on every job. You got this energy. You're on fire. And whatever they tell you, yeah, I'll do it. And you'll get in there and you work hard and work hours and hours and hours. But then when you've been doing it for 20 or 30 years, like, you know, I just like to do something I want to do, you know. I got some good ideas too, you know. And that's where I'm at. But the desire never leaves you. Art is a lifelong obsession or something. And the more you push it, the more you learn, the more you see you need to learn. And it's a never-ending cycle, and I love it.
Yo, thank you so much for talking with our listeners, and I hope you have a great time here with the remains of the show.
I've already had a great time, and I know I will continue to have a good time. And thank you.
We found a quiet little niche here at the Artist at Showcase. I'm sitting here with a longtime listener, Chris Burdett.
Hey, how's it going?
Yeah, Chris, where can people find samples of your work?
You can find my work on the interwebs at ChristopherBurdett.com and ChristopherBurdett.blogspot.com.
He's so camp. All right, we've also got Pia Wanachaiwang. And Pia, maybe you could tell us, where can people find samples of your work?
My work can be found at piastudios.com. That's P-I-Y-A, studios with an S at the end, .com.
Are you telling me you didn't want to spell out Wanachaiwang in your URL for...
Well... I'll spell out my name all I damn well please. It's the poor art directors I don't want to make spell out my name. I'm never going to get work if they have to memorize piawanachaiwang.com now, am I?
That might be problematic. And we got Ryan Yee.
Hello, you can find my work at ryanyee.com, and it's Yee with two E's. And Monster Girls Blogspot, and Monster Girls is spelled with the Z at the end because I'm edgy.
All right. Well, let's see, guys. We have ourselves a mighty little panel here in the corner. And maybe you guys could describe a little bit. I'll give you each a turn. Maybe you could describe a little bit of your work and what you were hoping to learn here at ILXCon and what you feel you've gained from your experiences here. We still have one more day to go, I understand. But, you know, there's been all the demos have passed now. And it's pretty much going to be, most of our time is going to be spent in the art show tomorrow, I believe. So we'll start with, once again, we'll start with Chris.
What's the question?
What is your favorite color, and do you wear it often at functions?
Wait, so the question is, what kind of stuff I do, and what I got out of this?
Yeah, that was exactly what I said. It's amazing you've got an eidetic memory, my friend.
Okay. Basically, a lot of my work is originally started off as character turnarounds, black and white drawings for miniatures, and I've slowly segued into interior art and card art and that kind of stuff because there's really not that much turnaround miniature work out these days. What I was hoping to get here was just basically some one-on-one time with some art directors, which I did get and got some great feedback, and just bouncing my work off of other artists that are kind of further along the escalator of art, a little further, higher up on the escalator, and kind of getting their take at what I can do to improve my game. And I did all that in spades, and it's been amazing.
What was your favorite? What was your favorite activity in terms of demo or presentation?
The acrylic demo with Michael Whalen and Christopher Moeller. It was epic. But I think for my money, it was the art director panel with John Shindahedi and Jeremy Cranford and Ben Thompson and
Lou Anders.
Lou Anders and
Rob.
Yeah, that thing was really sweet, and it was basically the audience had 2 hours to ask the art directors what were their concerns, thoughts, and questions about how art directors work and. You can't get any better than that. They were funny and informative, and 2 hours of gold. Pure gold.
Sweet. Now, how about yourself, Pia?
Well, I came to a LuxCon because I had been missing out on way too many cons. I mean, I went to New York Comic Con back in, like, February. I missed Gen Con, which was a really dumb idea. So I was like, okay, I'm going to come here, and I'm going to damn make up for everything that I lost. And, you know, I was really glad I came. I've been in this game trying to, like, sell my portfolio, I guess, 3 years now. And, you know, I still have yet to break in, but I feel so close now. And I wasn't sure. I mean, I'm not completely green anymore, but, you know, I still definitely need to come here. I'm so glad I did. I met some artists that I, you know, really want to see. I wasn't even sure they were coming, but, like, William O'Connor, who John Shindahedi just recently turned me on to through his blog, artorder.blogspot.com, and Donato, I got to see again, and, you know, just everybody. And Lars Grant West, who I really have to give a shout out to. He really helped us, like, was really generous during the Art Order submissions stuff and things like that. And finally, an added bonus was, like, Jeff Isley and Larry Elmore were here. I think they're the grandfathers of this fantasy industry. When I was a kid, I could not find any art related to fantasy, and the first art book I ever got of fantasy was TSR Art. It was those guys, and I think, maybe, I don't know, but to me, they were the ones who started this. And it's just like, oh my god, there's so much history, so much story. This is such a huge industry now. We've gone so far, and it's just really exciting to be a part of it.
And this show has a way of really making that, just bringing that to the fore, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. And, you know, I'll tell you, when I first started, you know, I believe, like, a lot of students believe fresh out of school was, like, these art directors or these, you know, really elitist, egotistical maniacs who basically never pay attention to anyone's portfolios. And over the years, going to cons, I've realized, you know, they're good people. They're just, maybe they're overworked, overwhelmed, I don't know. They are. But, you know, you just get more confidence. You just believe in this industry a little more. It doesn't feel so intimidating. It starts to feel just so much more open. And, you know, it just feels more possible, everything, you know, which is absolutely exciting.
And how about yourself, Ryan?
Well, right now I'm actually working for a concept studio doing, or a video game studio doing concept artwork. And I kind of made the transition into starting doing illustration. My first freelance job is actually for Wizards of the Coast doing magic cards. And I'm kind of trying to get sucked into that world and understanding what that's all about. It's a lot of pressure, though, because there's so many good artists in it, and I feel like I have to step up. So that's why I kind of came to this and talk to everybody else that's doing it, understand what's out there and what I need to do to raise my work to that level. And just the artist community has been the best thing for me, for the best experience for me with this whole thing, because there's just so many, like, cool artists in that are really personable, and you just really get a sense of the community, and you just really want to grow. So I think that's what I kind of got out most.
So I guess in summation, would you guys do this show again? What do you think?
I would do this in a heartbeat. There's one more thing I wanted to add. It's amazing how friendly, courteous, and gracious fantasy artists are. And I sent in the question to Ninja Mountain before about, is this indicative of the field? Because I come from a makeup effects background where people will stab you in the back. And I'm just in awe about how open and willing to help the artists here are. And it makes you feel good. It makes you feel good that you made this decision to get into this industry and this field and do stuff and to kind of rub shoulders with these people, because at the end of the day, it's like it's good to be around good people.
Well, I think Christopher pretty much just said everything I want to say and then some. So, yeah, I mean, like you said, like I mentioned, I met some artists I really admired, like William O'Connor. I just kept... I think the guy really wants to get rid of me after a while, but he definitely didn't show it, thankfully. And also, you get to meet your own peers, you know? I mean, I knew Chris's work even before I came here. He was the punk who kept submitting to Art Order and, you know, making John pay attention to someone else's art piece besides mine, so... But now I can put a face to the art, and, you know, that's great, that's cool. It's another person who's in this sometimes very enjoyable field, sometimes feels like being fed to wolves field, you know, and that's just really something. There's this field, by its very nature, has no structure, has very little support. The support we need, the support we get, is from each other, or each other's competitors and each other's support. It's a dynamic I think you won't find in too many other fields of any sort in this world.
And what I am absolutely shocked by, because there's several artists' work I really like, and I've followed their work, and I love their work, and when I finally see the work in person, these paintings in person, like Steve Prescott's or Lars Grant West's work in person, I'm floored by how poor the quality of reproduction that we have in printing is. You know, you think the book or whatever, it has great quality, and then you see the originals, and it's night and day, the original pieces of work. To have the opportunity to see these iconic pieces that, you know, especially even like Jeff Easley's stuff, who I unfortunately had to share a cab with from the airport. It was 30 minutes of sheer hell, being able to pick his brain. You know, to see these original cover art from, you know, the 80s and stuff, and it floored me, absolutely floored me. Kind of speechless seeing these things in person.
All right, guys. Hey, you know, thank you very much for talking with us. I know Ryan got really busy there. It's understandable, sir. You did some excellent work. And, if you'd like to say anything to our Ninja Mountain listeners before we go.
See you at Alexicon 2010.
Ditto. AluxCon, great time. I mean, it was just everything I expected and more. And also, you know, I mean, I've been in this game for 3 years. I'm still at it, still chopping away. And if I can survive this long, I think anyone can. So, yeah, keep at it.
I'll try to be back next year. I met a lot of really cool people and made some good friends. So, yeah, I had a good time. I'll see you there.
All right. Thanks, guys. All right, I'm here with Cynthia Shepherd, regular contributor to Imagine FX and freelance illustrator. Maybe you could describe to us your relationship with the popular magazine Imagine FX.
I was first contacted by Imagine FX by one of their editors a few months back, around I guess April, for a tips feature that they ran middle of 2009. And that piece ended up being bumped to a later issue, but through that kind of worked my way in, got a workshop spread, and now I'm doing Q&As for them, which are awesome. I love doing it because it means doing a lot of new work in a short amount of time and helping people, which are two of my favorite things.
Now, what kind of questions do you typically field on behalf of the magazine?
I do field a lot of technical questions with digital painting. I'm a pretty seasoned Photoshop user, so a lot of people come to the magazine with questions about, you know, how do I make something look a specific texture? How do I make some skin look real and things like that? And those are my favorite kinds of questions to answer because they're very logical. You know, there's kind of an order to them. And there's also 700 different ways you can make something look like something. So trying to play to people's unique needs is a challenge I like to meet.
Mm-hmm. And outside of your work for Imagine FX, what kind of freelancing do you do?
I do work for small RPGs and card games, as well as book covers. And I have a few private clients and a couple of publishers that I've been sort of working with on and off for the past couple of years. I love illustrating stories. I like taking any kind of narrative and putting it on canvas or putting it on screen.
So when did you get your start, and how did you begin this relationship with the magazine, for instance?
I got my start in illustration probably around the time I was born. I was born into an artistic family, so they sort of fostered my love for art from a young age. I ended up going to college at the Corcoran College of Art and Design in D.C., and they didn't have an illustration program, so it wasn't until much later that I decided fantasy art was for me. But I've been collecting Spectrum since I was 14 and looked at a lot of fantasy art, and I said, well, someone out there must do this for a living. And it wasn't until I met Dan Dos Santos back in 2007, and he introduced me to a lot of the people that helped get me into the industry and helped foster my imagination. And Imagine FX sort of came later. I think they discovered me on CG Society, which is a great resource for artists who are experienced or just starting up in the digital fields, mm-hmm. As well as DeviantArt and Conceptart.org.
Yep. Now, how did you come to learn about IlluxCon, and how did you come to, what were some of the things that you hoped for when arriving? What are the things you hoped to learn?
I think I read about IlluxCon the first time on Irene Gallo's blog, the art department, a couple years ago, 2008, I guess, when it started. And I came last year, and it was probably the most fun weekend I've ever had in my life. I got the most inspiration, the most new experience, the most feedback on my portfolio, which was still kind of blossoming very, very early at the time. Got invaluable just critique from all kinds of different artists, met a lot of people who I consider friends now, and it's sort of like a cool art summer camp that happens in one weekend. And in the winter.
Thank you so much for speaking with us. Where can people learn more about your work?
People can go to my website, www.shepard-arts.com. And I also have a blog, which links off of that site at shepard-arts.blogspot.com.
Ah, sweet. All right. Well, thanks for speaking with us. And, good luck with today's program.
Thanks so much.
All right. Well, here we are once again at IlluxCon. This is the Artist Showcase, and part of the show is also allowing collectors to showcase some of their own work and their collections. And IlluxCon, one of the main focuses of IlluxCon is for collectors. And I wanted to talk with a couple of the visitors here. We have Greg Oboff, and Michael Stubbs. And gentlemen, I guess I'd like to know, first off, what are some of the things that you look for in collecting art? What are some of your motivations for collecting art? And we'll start with Greg here.
Just a love of the subject matter, I guess. Whatever draws my eye to it and mm-hmm. what I like. And it ranges. The more I get into it, the more genres I'm opening to.
Certainly.
Well, from an early age, a lot of it's just some of the fantasy artists are just like kind of idols, like the Hildebrand brothers and things like that, where you've seen them. Well, I was just at the right age, when Star Wars came out in 77. And I don't know if the Hildebrand brothers did like the original Star Wars painting. But as a collector, I was able to buy one of their pieces when they had the Star Wars series in 95. And when I went to get it, I got to spend a day with the brothers Hildebrand. I got to see the original Luke Skywalker shirt. And I got to model for the box art cup, the box art of Ultima Online 2. So, yeah, I was the ogre in the middle of the painting. So, and of course, Ultima Online 2 didn't do very well. EverQuest came out shortly and kind of killed it. So I was in an obscure Hildebrand Brothers painting. But the other artists, Frazetta and Boris, in the late 70s and early 80s, there just weren't a ton. There weren't a ton of famous artists. And in 95, I got to meet Frank Frazetta at the Frazetta Museum down in Florida. And I met Boris the same year. I had moved out east. I grew up in Illinois, and there's nothing in Illinois. So, but now, being able to come and talk with the artists and sit down and listen to them talk, it's just been amazing here this weekend. For any painter or collector, I couldn't recommend this higher, to come out and get to sit and talk with people you've idolized for 20, 30 years. So
would you say some of the things that guided your first purchases, would you say were those things that, these are things that you enjoyed when you were younger, and you found yourself years later with the ability to purchase some of these things, and what were some of the impressions you got from the first time you saw, say, a piece of art in the flesh, pieces that you grew up with admiring, and all of a sudden you have this original piece of art in front of you? And
I couldn't believe it. It's just, that's so naive. It's just like, one day it's like, oh my God, I can actually own the original art on that book cover that I saw, or in the Hildebrand art book, or in the Boris book, or whatever it was back in the 70s and 80s, just like Michael said. It's those memories stay with you all your life, and then when you see it at Jane Frank's or wherever for sale, a whole new world was opened up. It's like, oh my God. So when you get the first one in, you just sit there in shock. I'm sorry to say, it sounds stupid, but you just sit there like, I've got a painting, and now I've got like 30 paintings. It's a feeding frenzy. It's a great feeding frenzy there.
Yeah, like you said, when you see an original for the first time, especially a famous original, like at the Frazetta Museum, it was Death Dealer and Conan, you know, and some of these paintings that are just icons in themselves, to see them in real life, and it's like, that's the painting itself. It's just amazing. And then, you know, later you come to hunt things down, or you start to become better at hunting things down. But at first, it was really just, I was lucky enough to buy one of these, you know, a print with a remark from Frazetta, and I really started with collecting autographs. But yeah, it progresses on to, you want a piece of the art. And when you can find original, well, like, there's such a range of today, you know, here, you could buy a painting for $12,000, you could buy a watercolor sketch for $30, and, you know, and it's going to help one artist or it's going to help another artist. And this is amazing that, you know, there's so much sharing here of information. And, you know, I sat with Larry Elmore, Don Mates, Bob Eggleston, Michael Whelan, and Donato Giancola last night, and they're saying, why didn't we get together and talk like this 30 years ago? And it's like, but, you know, the young artists now get on, and, you know, they've got videos. I asked Larry, I said, Larry, why don't you have a drawing video? I don't know. I don't, you know, he didn't have time. And Donato's got a video coming out. Dan Dos Santos has got a video coming out. So, you know, the sharing, and I think the Internet's made that way more possible, to share information or share tips. So, you know, someone said Dan Dos Santos, a lot of his stuff's on YouTube clips of how to paint and how to paint better, because, you know, there's so much great art, and it's so great that artists now are willing to share that information. It used to be, oh, it's a trade secret, and we can't tell you, you know. And now it's like, if you want to learn something, you almost can email a professional artist and ask them a question. And of the artists I've seen here this weekend, I'm sure all of them will give you an honest, helpful answer, you know. It's just, you know, Dave Seeley was talking about Virtual Studio, where they have 13 different artists to get together, critique each other's work, and they'll use Photoshop to change something and say, what do you think of this now? Or, you know, she looks too short, and they can stretch her, make her taller, and things like that. And it's still their work, but it's, you know, they're being helped with that constructive criticism, and it's, you know, it's just amazing to see and hear and see the artwork when it's completed. I'm sure you're able to walk around the show and see some of the things. It's just...
Yeah, one of the things that was striking, and I know I've talked with a number of artists, and they seem to agree that, well, as good as the quality of printing is today, it's still pale when you look at the actual physical original hanging on the wall. It has a different impact, a different presence than on the printed page, and colors that you didn't even imagine existed in the printed image. Once you see it in the original, you're seeing so many layers of subtlety that the camera just cannot really pick up.
Yeah.
What are some of the things that you, what are some of your thoughts on the digital revolution amongst fantasy artists? What has that done to your collecting habits? I mean, as an example,
frustration, to be honest. But along with that, I understand that it's the new technology. It helps the artists get the deadlines done, create some phenomenal art, which I love. And I'm at the point of thinking, okay, you did that digital. Will you recreate that as a real painting for me? And some of them said, yeah. So I'm starting to pursue that maybe as a means to, well, I, once you start collecting original art, this is part of the seven sins maybe. The gluttony, it's like once you get the original, you don't want posters, or at least I don't want posters anymore, because I know I can have these and put them on the wall. There's nothing wrong with posters. It's all good. But to have the originals, so to me a digital is a digital. And it's sad because it's in the bytes in the computer. And what if somebody pulls the plug one day and there's no original nowhere? Well, so what for a lot of people. But for me, it's like, it's kind of sad. You know, and they say, well, I got all these prints, you know, seven layer colors and all of this. And they're beautiful. They're gorgeous. And it's great for what it does for them. But to a collector, it's bittersweet. Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, I won't say I totally agree, because I feel that illustration is kind of in a gray area as far as originals and digital. I mean, I was kind of saddened when I looked at the last issue of Spectrum, and it's like media, digital, media, digital, media, digital mix, and things like that. It's like, it saddens me in one way, but I know what I guess the part that saddens me is, like he said, there's not an original of that somewhere. I'm, you know, it's a beautiful image, and I'm sure it's what the client wanted, and that's really a part. You know, it's not good to have too many starving artists. So I'm glad to see that people can get work like that and get more illustration work out there. But I'm equally glad to see, you know, some of the young artists that are still doing things, you know, in the original fashion and in the original medium. So when I collect, I mean, I obviously have to sometimes collect prints, but they're archival prints. And I will say, for printed media, I'm glad that they limit the editions on most of them, because that then makes it more valuable to me. If I know I have one of only 50 or one of you know, 100, then to me that makes the print much more. And again, like with a remark, you know, which is an original sketch on a print, that's something that the artist can do that says, I still have the original talent, but, you know, I need to sell 100 copies of this to pay the bills and keep working as an artist, not have to, you know, take a second job or whatever. So I'm glad to see there's a place for digital media, but I'm glad to see that there's still artists who paint the old-fashioned way. And boy, sitting and watching some of the demonstrations this weekend of, you know, Donato Giancolo doing the portrait, and that was amazing to watch. But even like just at their booth, watching Boris and Julie Bell, you know, just sit there and keep working on a painting and keep working on it, you know, and see how the real thing was done. Julie painted this little horse on a piece for the next year's calendar, and it was just amazing to see it go from white canvas to, you know, just completed fantasy Pegasus, you know, because, you know, you can't draw a Pegasus from life. So, but it was amazing to see her use, you know, she just dipped the oil brush, she changed the color, and it was just amazing to watch. So, yeah, as a collector, I understand, but I'm also glad to see people do it the old way, too.
And I was talking with my friend Jeff Mangus, who's also exhibiting here tonight, and he was pointing out that it's quite a thing to see an event like IlxCon, because you're seeing a very large room filled with traditional painters. A lot of traditionalists are in the room, and you get to see a lot of original art just sitting there for the viewing. And it's rather rare. It's becoming increasingly rare. You know, you're seeing a lot of venues are really focused on print sales, but a show like IlxCon is a bit more collegial, and we're talking about the digital as well. But traditional is getting pride of place in this event, and it's really interesting to hear the collectors, you know, enjoying the venue as much as the artists.
Yeah.
You know, I have to ask, what are some of if you were to give any advice to, say, some of our young listeners or people who are just starting, you know, or just starting out, or even more established people, what are some of the advice you might give to those who might be interested in getting a collector's attention?
I guess to the young artists, don't set your prices so high that you can't afford to be an artist. You know, it's great. Some of the most amazing artwork I've seen done was on Jefferson Square in New Orleans, where the sketch artist will do a sketch in 10 minutes for $10. Mm-hmm. And you see him do 3 or 4 portrait sketches in an hour, and it's amazing to watch how well they can capture the likeness. So anytime you can practice drawing people and drawing things like that, and, you know, draw your friends for $10, you know, they'll want to keep it, and it's all more and more practice. I heard a story of somebody who worked as a Disney animator, and they talk about, oh, people who animate, they'll draw something 300 times to get good at drawing that. Somebody for Disney will draw it 3,000 times so that they can draw it in their sleep, you know, and things like that. It's, for young people, it's like practice, 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 because it all continues to build your knowledge of what you can do, and try different things, and go see real art. Go to the museum and look at a Rembrandt, look at a Bouguereau, you know, look at a Van Gogh, and look at the color, and look at, like, perfect execution and things like that. And just, you know, exercise, just like athletes exercise every day to stay in shape. They don't just practice on Saturday before the game. Every day, artists should be, like, drawing, they should be painting or doing something to just stay, you know, keep moving so that they constantly sharpen. And whatever your weakness is, start working on that so you overcome it and master it, and everything comes together as, you know, I can paint feathers, I can paint skin, I can paint a background. You know, I was telling someone, as a portrait artist, I feel sorry for the guys that have to paint the couch because there's three kids sitting on it. And it's like, wow, who thinks about painting a couch? But if you look at those, a lot of those couches have an intricate pattern in there somewhere, and the artist has to paint that as well as the three kids or the client. And the client wants it done, you know, all these things that, you know, whatever you think it is, keep drawing it. And if you have trouble, you know, step back and draw it easier, or, you know, take a tracing paper and trace the outline and then fill it in. You know, do things to correct your mistakes, and especially with perspective. Ask someone else to look at it and say, you know, this is what's wrong. His arm wouldn't work in that angle or whatever. Have other people critique your work, because anytime I work on something, if I work on it for 3 hours straight, I look, sit back and go, oh yeah, it looks great. I come back the next day and go, what the hell happened to my piece of art? You know, it's get other critiques, you know, especially along the way. You know, while it's in a sketch form, get a critique so you get that proportion right. So, to young artists, I just say practice, you know, and hang out with people that are going to encourage you to be the kind of painter you want to be. If someone's like, oh, that's not, you know, if you hang out with slackers, you're going to slack. If you hang out with people that are excited about art and about painting and drawing, you know, you can push each other, and that feedback loop makes everybody better. So that's the advice I have to young artists.
Certainly.
You have to share there?
Just exposure. Like you said, get your friends, get everybody you can. Get your stuff out there. I mean, paint them, because they'll come to appreciate it. They'll see your talent grow. Websites, you know, get on the web. Do the YouTube stuff. Do whatever to get your stuff out there. Come to the conventions. I mean, LXCon is alone in the field, because thanks to Pat Wilshire for doing it last year. I mean, this is dedicated purely to the artists, whereas all the Comic Cons and Gen Cons are for the gamers and the role players and the fans, which is great, but they normally stuff the artists back in a corner, and it's not much about them. But the odd thing to me is their stuff is what sold everything to begin with. If it hadn't been for their painting on that cover or on this, somebody might not have bought it. So get with the artists, like Michael said. Talk to them. I've seen more artists here be happy to critique new young artists. They said, would you mind? Yeah, I'd love to look at your stuff. And there, a lot of them are very frank, very honest, and said, you know, this is great right here, but you need to work on this and work on this. So the more feedback you can get, the better. And like Michael said also, hang out with people that are going to encourage you. Don't let somebody get you down. Just get out of that psyche. And, you know, you can do it. Just take your time. Even if you got to step back for a little bit and then go back to it and work on it again, do that. But don't get so frustrated and give up, because you can do it. It's just the patience.
Well, thank you so much, gentlemen. It's really interesting. I know our listeners will take a lot of what you just said to heart, and it's been an excellent talking with you.
It's good talking to you too, Jeremy.
Thank you.
Thanks for asking.
All right, we're here once again, and who is joining us but none other than Patrick McAvoy. Patrick, it's amazing to find you here, sir. We're seeing some of the fruits of the master class that you attended, I presume. And actually, no, I joke, because this is Aaron Miller, who thinks I'm Patrick McAvoy. So, you know, Aaron, tell folks a little bit about yourself real quickly. I know we've met you at Gen Con, but...
I just kept painting, and I'm at ILXCon, and Pat Wilshire gave us the opportunity to do this showcase event, which we've got 3 hours to just kind of show the other artists and collectors the up and comers, the new guys that are just giving it a shot.
How has response been to the pieces you've been showing?
I've actually been impressed and humbled that a lot of the big artists come by and nice compliments and people who have actually been going to my website and have seen my art in other places. It's really nice to hear that someone's seen your work and likes it and maybe buys a print. It's been pretty cool.
You were here throughout all the show. And what were some of your favorite moments within the show?
Any panel that Jordi Ushel is in, he's the life of the party. Donato was great watching him do a portrait demonstration. You can't get enough of the art show itself. That's mind-melting. If you can make it through without talking to a friend that you know, an artist that you know, it takes literally 3 days to make it the whole 800 square feet of the event. It's intense.
So, yeah, man, geez. No, given all the things that you've experienced, I presume you'll be returning to us next year to see the big event, or?
I'll be here for ILLXCON no matter what. If Patrick gives us this opportunity to have this showcase again, I'll be in it. I look forward to the day that I'm in the big boy table and have a real table. But, you know, I've got to have the awesome.
And if you will, would you define the awesome for us within context of what you've seen here these last 3 days?
The awesome. That it could be a name like Raul Vital or Mark Zug, Christopher Burdett.
Booyah!
It's putting in the hours and never giving up. I've got a lot of hours to put in and a lot of not giving up to go through.
Oh man, I know I've learned a lot from these last few days, and it is very humbling and very educational. You know, there's so many things that we as artists would like to accomplish, and we're seeing people who have accomplished some of those things, and it becomes attainable in our minds, I think. And you ask people for advice, and they're so willing to give it. You know, they're very generous here. You know, with what they're doing. So,
yeah, that's awesome. I keep hearing that at least in the fine art or the illustration fantasy world, that everyone is just so helpful, so willing to help you get further. Critiques, reviews, even the art directors are just more than willing to give you their time. You know, they flew in here just to meet with a couple of us. It's been great.
So, well, you know, Aaron, it's great to talk to you once again. I know this has been kind of overwhelming. It's an amazing event, and I hope that people will be joining this event next year. And, good luck with the remainder of the show, sir. It's good to see you.
Thank you. And can I give you my website?
Please.
It's aaronbmiller.com.
Thank you very much, sir.
Thank you.
Well, I'm here with Michael Whalen, and many of you are already familiar with Michael's work, and maybe we could learn a little bit. How did you get your start within genre illustration?
Simplest answer is I heard about a Comic-Con in 1974 when I was still at Art Center, and for some reason, when I saw the poster for the convention, something clicked in my head and said, it's time to start showing my work. And so I took some pieces down to the Comic-Con and sold most of what I had there in the art show, and that encouraged me to enter work into the art show at the World Science Fiction Convention that year, which was in Washington, D.C., and I met somebody at the Comic-Con who was willing to take some of my work to that show, and I told her, if you put it up in the show, list it as professional work, not amateur, because I want to see how I do.
Yeah.
And I got first place for science fiction, you know, at the convention. So that gave me the courage to submit my work to some publishers in New York. And one of them sent me a letter saying that they might have a job for me. So I sold whatever wouldn't fit into my Volkswagen and drove out to the East Coast. And I walked in the Daw Books. They had a manuscript, and I did my first book cover assignment, and I've never looked back.
Now, even back then, were your first assignments, were these conducted with oils or acrylics? I understand you're an acrylic artist.
I started out in oils, but because I have a tendency to end up working on a painting till the last second, and I knew what kind of problems I'd have trying to deliver work that was still wet or tacky. I decided early on that I was going to have to make a transition into working with acrylics, so I started buying acrylics and doing more and more of my work in acrylics, and gradually made a transition. So since the late 70s, about 85% of my work is in acrylics and the rest is in oils.
Who are you? Who are some of your art heroes? I mean, who are some of the people that got you interested in the genre, for instance?
Well, Frazetta, of course. Mm-hmm. A lot of the early classic illustrators, Norman Rockwell, Maxwell Parrish, the Piles, Howard Pyle, the Wyeths, you know, a lot of the same heroes that my peers have. In the science fiction community, outside of Frazetta, Kelly Freeze was a big influence. The artist Ed Emshwiller, who was very big in the late 50s and all during the early 60s, was a very big influence also. And finally, there's an artist named Ed Cartier, who had the most amazing imagination for creating aliens. And I used to search out books that had his illustrations in them because I loved the way that he created aliens. They look so bizarre and so different from anybody else's that, you know, I just loved his work. That was a big influence also.
Now, do you divide your time between book covers and some of your private work, some of the gallery type of work?
I am this year. I haven't done a book cover in many years. The last one is probably 5 or 6 years ago, I think. But I'm actually going to be doing one when I get back from this event here. It's a significant book, and I enjoyed it a lot, and I've been promising a book cover for Tor Books for at least 10 years. And Tom Doherty and I were at a convention together, and when we were sitting at the banquet, he was right next to me and grabbed my arm and said, okay, I want you to give me a date when you'll do an assignment for me. And so I decided it was time to stop temporizing and actually get one done. I've been doing some commissioned assignments this year. I've been doing some work for Stephen King's website, and I've done some album covers for death metal bands and things like that. Fun stuff.
Now, what are some of the inspirations behind some of your personal work? Because I see these decaying, surrealist landscapes, and some of them a bit more organic as well. I'm seeing, for instance, a woman walking across a stair, basically a bridge of crustaceans.
Ammonite fossils.
Yep. Ammonite fossils. What are some of the things that kind of guide those pieces?
Well, I've got a series of works, a different series, and most of my personal works fall into one or another of these series. They're all highly symbolic, and usually have more than one level of meaning. There's a surface level and then some inner levels underneath that. But I've got a series of paintings called my Faded Star paintings. They all have vast concrete surfaces and barriers that people are trying to get past. And it's all about overcoming obstacles on one level. Another level, they're about my disappointment the wilting of the national will for the space program, and it deals with the notion of progress in society and in technology. The paintings that have the ammonite fossils in them are all about virtues. The ammonites are symbols of extinction. When I use the nautilus, it's a symbol of survival because it's one species in the whole family of ammonites and floating nautiloids that has survived over billions of years, the Jurassic extinction. So I employ those as symbols depending upon whether pessimistic or optimistic at a particular time when I'm doing a painting. And most of the paintings are reactions to things that I'm seeing going on in the world around me. They're just told. The language I use is one of fantasy and symbolism. But they're communicating things that I'm experiencing in my personal life. And being a successful illustrator and being booked up 2 years in advance or whatever, it prevented me from getting any sort of sense of immediacy to my work, and I started to really regret that later in my career as an illustrator. So my fine art career was largely about regaining a sense of immediacy to my work and being able to read something in the newspaper that got me pissed off and throw it down the table and walk right up to my studio and start a painting right that minute about what I was feeling that day. And that's a luxury, and I'm so glad I've given myself that luxury to do that, because it's led me into paths of imagery that I probably wouldn't have gotten into if I had just continued my illustration career.
Have you been able to work, in for instance, in this image for Irene Gallo over at Tor, have you been able to perhaps influence some of your freelance work with some of your more private, you know, motivations within the symbolism?
There's some crossover. I've sold the rights to a lot of my personal pieces, and they've ended up on book covers through the back door, so to speak, and that's kind of nice when that works out, but... Because I'm working in a world of fantasy, you know, there are applications to some of the personal pieces that I'm doing. But in terms of bringing what I'm doing in my personal work into my illustration from a deliberate standpoint at the onset of doing an illustration assignment, I haven't been too successful in doing that. And I'm not sure it's really going to work for this particular assignment either. But we'll see. We'll see. As long as I give myself the freedom to have fun with it and enjoy what I'm doing, then that'll be enough for me, I think.
What maybe in light of your career here, what are some of the things that you might suggest to somebody just starting out, having the experiences that you've had? What are some of the things that you would do differently, as an example?
That's a tough question, because it's been 30 years since I started, you know, and everything's different now. The world's different, and from my discussions with art directors and interactions with people still working in the business, the bottom line is that really good work always manages to succeed, you know, in bringing artists into recognition and on a pathway to success. So the most valuable thing a beginning artist can cultivate is an accurate sense of your relative quality compared to what other people in the field you intend to go into are doing. That's the thing I see the least in portfolios that I review, is that the people showing me the work aren't aware of the fact of their own shortcomings. And I don't know how you acquire the clear vision to see where your work is falling short and to be able to correct that, but that's an extremely valuable talent to have or resource to fall on. And the artists who really make it are ones who can accurately see their deficiencies, at least the important ones, and correct for them and get their... And then it's just a matter of working on your painting and or on your work until it's up to the level of quality that you have visualized. But if you can't do it internally, then you need to marry somebody or have a roommate or somebody who's unafraid to give you absolute straightforward criticism of your work, you know, and not accept your excuses for things that aren't working out in the painting. My wife is my ideal critic. You know, she knows where I'm trying to go in a piece. And but you know, if a hand doesn't look right or something looks, the leg looks too big, she'll say there's something wrong with that leg. You know, she may not be able to pinpoint what it is, and I ignore her comments at my peril, because and times I have, and then seen the painting published in a poster, or on a book cover, or on a billboard on Sunset Strip, and I go, oh my God, why didn't I see that? You know, it's you know, so it's a very important skill, and that's something that I see lacking in a lot of people who are trying to break into the business. And,
yeah, basically, you know, find somebody that can give you an honest appraisal of what you're doing, and or a group of people, you know, your peers, and be open to what they're going to say.
Yes.
We have confidence, but at the same time, be honest with yourself.
Yeah.
You know, about what you're doing.
The other thing is, I think people. Young people too easily fall into an automatic attitude of copying what their heroes are doing, and the greatest thing you can do is to realize you're here to do your work, not somebody else's. Somebody else is already doing, Mobius is already doing Mobius's work. We don't need another Mobius doing Mobius's work. We need whoever you are to do the work that only you can do. You know, each of us has lived a separate, unique life with different influences, and you should draw upon what it is that makes you a unique person and and use that in your artwork because it'll make your artwork unique and uncopyable by somebody who hasn't lived your life. Does that make any sense? I had an assistant briefly. When I broke my hand in my karate class, I couldn't open up the paint jars, so I needed someone to sit behind me in my studio to open the jars for me while I was trying to get some work done. And he really wanted to become a fantasy artist. And everything he did looked like a pastiche of things I had done. And I started talking to him, and he was a Vietnam veteran. You know, he knew what it was like to walk through a jungle, to wade through an infested, stagnant river water and have leeches on him and to experience gunfire in a monsoon and all that. And I said, you got this incredible wealth of experience that you should be drawing from and bringing into your work. It doesn't mean you have to paint war pictures, but... I could never paint a scene of a jungle, a tropical jungle from the Far East, because I've never experienced that. Just like I have trouble painting horses because I haven't ridden one. You know, I fake it and I get by when I have to do it. But someone who has a horse or has ridden one, like Boris, is innately going to get a better sense of what a horse feels like when it's time to paint one. Anyway, if he would draw from his personal range of experience, another thing that he was a cop for a while. And he had to watch over a site of an airplane crash, you know, where there, and so the FAA could come and document it and everything. And I said it was a horrible experience. There were bodies laying around and stuff, but absorb that information and you add it to your well of experience and use it to inform your artwork. You've got a wealth of real experience that other people who have not experienced your life can't begin to, you know, everything. If they tried to do what you can do, it would look fake, whereas you've got the real thing. So be true to yourself. It's a short form of what I just blathered on about. But I think it's really important.
Thank you so much for talking with us. I know our listeners really appreciate that.
You're welcome.
All right. And have fun at the show.
Well, I'm having a lot of fun. I've learned so much just today. It's just amazing.
Did you happen to catch any demonstrations or presentations?
Yeah, sure.
What was your favorite?
My favorite was Donato's portrait painting demonstration. It was wonderful to watch a guy work. He's just a master.
Oh, man. That was actually my good friend Joe Acone. He was sitting for him. It was Joe and I traveled here together.
Yeah.
And Joe is a college student, just graduating this coming this year. So he was a kid in a candy store. He just happened to be in the right place, right time. They needed a model, and he just waved his hand.
Yeah.
And
that was great. I learned a lot. I was taking notes the whole time.
All right. Well, thank you.
You're welcome.
Well, I'd like to thank everyone who sat with me on Saturday to conduct these interviews. We had some amazing artists to meet, and I hope you enjoyed the show. Next week, we should have episode 41B, which continues the interviews that took place on Sunday. And I've been Jeremy McHugh, and I shall now cue the musication.